Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Midweek Takeaway. Today we're joined by noted writer and journalist Charles Archer, alongside geologist Martin Churchhouse from Kendrick Resources, to unpack the intriguing case of Kendrick Resources. In this session, we explore Kendrick's strategic pivot towards vanadium, a metal poised for substantial demand growth due to its applications in energy storage and steelmaking. As Kendrick navigates the low liquidity challenges of a microcap, we'll dissect their potential for high-risk investors, the implications of their recent projects, and their positioning within the competitive landscape of the vanadium market. Join us as we delve into the investing strategy, the Kendrick Resources edit, and what it means for the future of strategic metal investments.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Charles Arch here. I'm being joined today by Martin Churchhouse of Kendrick Resources. Hi, Martin. How are you?
Hi. Good, thank you.
Wonderful. How's your week been? What have you been up to recently?
Actually, just come back from some site visits and things on a variety of projects. So, come back to all the rain and miserable weather and, looking for an opportunity to cut the grass, but can't find one, yeah?
I'll tell you, my I'm down in Devon and I went on a bike ride yesterday with my 10-year-old. And we did like a good 20-mile trip, so like to Exmouth and back. And we looked up the weather beforehand and we realized the rain would be kind of following us back. And as we were cycling along the bike path, you could feel the rain at your back. And the incentive to go faster was quite strong. After a while, we kind of couldn't do it anymore and we just got soaking wet. But there we go. Such is life. That's kind of the taking the outdoor exercise risk in April in the UK. Yeah. Anyway, we're here to talk about Kendrick. So, I think we kind of jump right in. Kendrick's currently sitting in about a £1 million market capitalization. So it's one of those companies where you're kind of, if you're listening at the moment, it's a company where you could be getting in kind of undervalued valuation, which could rise quite substantially in the relatively near future. You launched your IPO in May 2022 and you fundraised £3.25 million, which is not too shabby. And the share price has calmed down a fair bit, but it doesn't match or it doesn't reflect the developments that you've had at the assets that you have. But before we go on to that, I want to have a quick chat about vanadium, because this is a metal that you're very exposed to. And I don't think many people understand the importance of vanadium in the metals market. So, Martin, I think we start with that. Why should investors have some kind of exposure to vanadium in their portfolio?
I think one of the things that, when we started, I must confess, I didn't know a huge amount about vanadium, but I've done a reasonable amount of background reading. And I haven't realized sort of the diversity of sort of use of the metal. Obviously, the sort of the principal use, about 90% currently of production, is going into steel manufacture as an alloy. But closely on the back of that, now you've got a growing demand, although it's not growing as quickly as we'd like, for the vanadium redox flow battery storage. So it's sort of in general energy storage. And there is also use in construction and aerospace. It's used as a sort of high strength material in areas where flexibility is needed and things like wiring, and also as a catalyst.
Interesting. I mean, you say 90% of it is made in steel, making stainless steel predominantly, right, as the alloy.
Yeah.
That's predicted pretty much by Chinese demand, I think most people would argue. Do you think there's going to be any problems with vanadium's price if China gets into economic troubles, or do you think that it's one of those markets that are going to stay relatively stable?
Look, I think any market where China has a grip on it is always going to be under some pressure, potentially. Because it's not just the case that if Chinese growth sort of takes off again, then there's going to be increased demand. The other thing, of course, is that China produces at least or more than 50% of the vanadium that is out there and available. So it does have an impact. And it, as a metal, I think one of the main constraints that it has is or has been its sort of price volatility.
Yeah.
Which is, again, it's just sort of a circular argument. It's the price volatility, which is linked to supply constraints, which again is linked back to China and depends on their demand. And I guess we've spoken to a few battery companies and some of them are sitting on the fence when it comes to committing to research and maybe development of sort of vanadium redox batteries, which at the moment I think only account for about 8% of vanadium
demand.
But the problem they have is how the price, you know, can escalate and sort of drop by 30% overnight. And that's a concern for them.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, we're talking vanadium redox flow batteries, just for anyone here who isn't aware of this. This is probably the most important growth case for vanadium. So as we said before, steel, stainless steel, that's where most vanadium is going. But the VRFBs is going to be huge demand, because vanadium has this essentially unique ability to store and release energy efficiently. It's got a really long lifespan, it's high charging cycle efficiency. If you compare it to lithium, for example, lithium batteries are much lighter and they charge much faster, but vanadium is non-flammable and has a much, much longer lifespan. So it's just much better for long-term energy storage. And I think, you know, what I'm getting at here is that when you've got a company like Kendrick that's got a couple, well, several, but a couple of really promising potential vanadium projects, if you see the RFB demand start to grow, you're going to need to get more vanadium out of the ground. And this is how Kendrick is positioning. Would you say that's probably pretty fair, Martin?
I would, yeah. I mean, talking about the vanadium redox flow batteries, that they have, you know, longevity or long duration. You can get at least 10,000 cycles out of a battery. They're scalable, which I think is a key factor, because most of the sort of projected uses in off-grid and sometimes isolated situations are where you want to store a decent amount of energy. It's ideal for backup power and things. And the other thing that it's particularly good at is it's very good at integrating with a whole range of different sort of power generating methods. So it will have its day. We're convinced about that. I think it's just a case of it's got to break out of, we need a significant uptake and an investment somewhere that's outside of China.
Do you think more research and development into the batteries to make them more viable economically, or do you think you're already there?
And I definitely there's scope for improvement. I mean, one of the things with the batteries at the moment is the system is quite expensive. That's partly driven by the metal being quite expensive. And the problem you have, of course, is that if the uptake of for the VRBs increases, then chances are the price of vanadium pentoxide will increase as well.
Yes.
Having said that, if it increases, then there's the motivation there for the battery manufacturers to look at producing something that's more cost effective. So I think it'll be, you know, it'll work itself out in that regard.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, this is the problem, isn't it? As it becomes more mainstream, potentially demand for vanadium will go up, the price will go up, and then obviously, ideally, Kendrick would benefit. It's kind of a self-limiting thing. I guess the other problem, it's not a problem, but it's the reality, which is that because they have such a long lifespan, but the upfront expense is so high, you're asking people to put in kind of like a decent amount of capital expenditure, and then it pays off for itself over time. So you really need the bigger players to get involved, who have that kind of like financial firepower to make that happen. And it is happening. It's just happening slowly. It feels slowly, but then maybe with lithium, it will slow for about 10 years and then it just exploded, didn't it? So maybe it'll be the same thing.
Do you know, I've heard that statement similar to that before, where people have said that they think that it's sort of, its evolution will be similar in that regard to lithium. So yeah, I think you could be right. All you need is a few more, you know, municipalities in the part of the world where they're, you know, they're committed to a green energy transition and are producing lots of power that's going to waste, lots of isolated communities and things, and you can start putting these vanadium redox plants in place, and hopefully they'll get some momentum from there.
Well, I mean, I do a fair bit of research into wind power in the UK, and so many wind farms are literally switched off because they don't have the energy storage when it's particularly windy, which I find insane. But, you know, especially when all you have to do is just build a vanadium battery and put it, you know, and put it on the ground, and it will keep that energy going. But, you know, such is life. Eventually it will get there. My only other question on vanadium before we move on to the projects that you have is on the current mines. It feels like with copper, with lithium, with everything, all of the decent mines are kind of like have been explored, and you're not getting any new quality production online. Why is that? Like, where it feels that there haven't been any like massive new discoveries over the past few years. Would you say that's fair or not?
In metals in general,
or in vanadium in particular, but metals in general, I suppose as well.
Yes, I think you're right, and I think that's partly again because it goes back to that whole question of the price volatility and when is it all going to sort of kick off and when will we get some momentum? I think that's the challenge. So I think people are, you know, there's a reluctance to start spending large amounts of money developing nickel projects until you, an alien project.
Yeah.
But you got an end use for it. Well, I think, I mean, you're talking about moving on to our projects, but I guess it's quite a good sort of link in that I think with our Ariake project,
yeah,
it's an interesting one. We're sitting there looking at the new results and things that have come through, and we're trying to decide whether we've got a vanadium project with iron ore or whether we've got an iron ore project with vanadium. And I think if you're in that situation where you've basically got a byproduct as such, whatever it happens to be it vanadium or iron ore, then I think you've got a little bit more motivation to look to develop.
Well, I guess your operating expenditure would be lower, and also you're protected to some. I suppose the actual vanadium and iron ore tend to follow each other regardless, but it tends to be the case if you've got more than one metal. Getting financing becomes a little bit easier. But I mean, you mentioned Ariake. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah,
Ariake. Ariake. Sorry, yeah, my Swedish fast Norwegian is potentially not great, but Ariake. I mean, so I did the math. So when you look at a compound annual growth rate of steel production through to 2030, I mean, the current predictions are kind of 2.7% growth per year. This is globally. So you need a project the size of Ariake to go into production every 3 years just to keep up with that amount of growth. And that doesn't include demand for the redox batteries. So, you know, I think there's going to be a supply gap at some point relatively soon. And just hopefully someone picks up on that and goes, hang on, Kendrick's got something really interesting here. Why don't we just, you know, give them a little bit of cash and let them get cracking? So Ariake, you know, I think we've touched on it now. So it's in Vittangi in Sweden. There's already a joint resource at the asset. I think it was established back in 2019. So 44.3 MT at 0.4% vanadium pentoxide. Yeah, this is a really, really interesting asset. I mean, it's not called your... I've decided it's your flagship. It may not be, but when I look through the asset books that you have, this is the one that, you know, particularly caught my eye. Can you tell me a little bit about the asset, sir?
Okay, yeah, it's in northern Sweden. We are in iron ore country. There's a long sort of mining heritage in the sort of the general region. It's an interesting project. We've now got 7 licenses. We've increased our number of licenses that we've got within the project itself. We've drilled 2 of the licenses. We are in the process of doing an updated resource estimate based on the drilling that we completed last year.
Yeah.
And we've got another 4 or 5 licenses that we still have some very, very nice looking airborne and ground magnetic data with the same signature as that which we found related to mineralization. And on the sort of north-northwestern side of the block of ground or the licenses, we've got quite an interesting copper signature as well that we need to look at in more detail. We've done a reasonable amount of test work. The results look good. We could produce a high-grade vanadium concentrate. What we're going to do now is once we've finished the resource estimate and we've decided where the high and lower grade of vanadium is located, we will collect a number of separate bulk samples, which we will have analyzed again with more detailed sort of met test work. At that point, we'll decide whether to continue drilling or whether we can start looking at sort of trying to convert the exploration license to a mining license.
Yeah, very good. I mean, you were talking about an updated mineral resource. How long do you reckon that will be before you have that ready? Is that a case of a few months or potentially?
Yeah, a couple of months at the most. Yes.
Oh, cool. Excellent. That's good to hear. Again, this joint result, it was back in, was it March 2019? I feel like that's right. It is when the initial results. So it'd be great to get some kind of update on that. Yeah. So, I mean, when I looked at like half of the vanadium pentoxide is concentrated in the magnetite at 1.7%. We won't get into technical detail. This makes the economics of extraction pretty good, I would say, right? Compared to like other projects worldwide, it seems to be at kind of at the top end. Is that right?
I would say so. Yes, definitely. Yeah. Particularly in terms of grade, it's up there for sure.
And then you've got the 13.3% projected recovery rate. Again, this is, you know, old numbers, and there's been more drilling since. But again, it's in line with major projects of this type. And given your surround, I mean, you are, as you say, you're in the right part of the world for it. You're literally surrounded by infrastructure. Why haven't we had somebody come forward and, you know, wants to do a joint venture or an earning or something similar with you? yeah, is it just a case of you don't want to, or that they're not quite ready to get into a partnership?
It's not something that we have, we've not actively sought a partner at this stage to be.
Right.
We were able to pick up the extra licenses. You know, we picked up when we acquired the assets in Kendrick, there were a lot of projects, and it's taken us quite a long time to advance some of the nickel and vanadium projects, but at the same time, whittle out some of the projects that we really didn't think had much upside, or we thought that they were going to be challenged for whatever reason, be it, you know, environmental or proximity to, you know, some Natura 2000 area or a town or something. So we go through all the projects. We've been whittling out the ones that we don't think have got potential. So that's taken up a reasonable amount of our time as well. And we wanted to get to a point where we felt that we had a portfolio with some real merit in it. You know, we picked up a couple of new projects recently as well, just to strengthen it. And now I think we are ready to move forward and to start, you know, considering talking to third parties for sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it's all about, isn't it? Because again, you know, with the market capitalization that you have, but with the assets that you have, you need to get somebody on board at some point, don't you? But obviously, you want to do it from a position of strength. And I guess once you've got that mineral resource out, so that's the point of the updated one for Area Key. I mean, that's going to be the point at which you go, right, let's go talk to the larger players, come, you know, do some work with us.
The other thing is that when there's a lot of sort of that myth and legend about sort of Scandinavia, and people say, oh, it's very expensive and it's very difficult to permit and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So we needed to convince ourselves that wasn't the case. Now, yes, okay, it is relatively expensive to explore there. But what we found with regard to things like the environmental legislation and permitting, it's very clear, it's very well laid out, it's been in position for a long time, the system works. If you comply and if you deliver what is asked for, then it's not difficult to get permits. And so you actually go into a project with a much higher degree of confidence than I think people assume, on the basis that as long as you do things the right way, you've got a very good chance that you're going to be able to progress. So once we knew that, you know, we're then ready to commit to drilling and other things.
Well, I guess also it'll depend whereabouts in each country the projects are. If you're in the middle of like an iron belt and you're surrounded by infrastructure, it seems to be the case that it's a lot easier than in other areas in Sweden and Norway. And you have most of your assets are in places where there's already mines or infrastructure close by. So it potentially it becomes easier to get licensed, to get whatever you need, you know, to get mining. So in a recent RNS, it said the business that you switched away from further drilling to expand the current mineral resources, we just said, and you are focusing on the development and implementation of an appropriate strategy to build a sustainable vanadium business. Can you talk about what this strategy is, or is it something that's kind of a bit private at the moment?
We're still working on it. I alluded to it earlier, actually.
I know. I'd rather push you on it. You know, sometimes I ask because you can't answer. So that's fine.
What I can tell you is it's a case of deciding whether we have, and it'll change. In different parts of the deposit, it'll be an iron ore deposit with a vanadium byproduct. In other parts of the deposit, it'll be a vanadium resource with an iron ore byproduct.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to figure all that out at the moment and how we develop.
Which one to go? I guess, well, obviously you have mineralogical studies and it will depend what kind of plant you have and what, I mean, obviously you've got infrastructure around it. Is there a chance that you're going to be able to use somebody else's plant, somebody else's processing facilities close by, or are you going to need your own plants on site, Area Key, for example?
Well, I mean, you've sort of hit on one of the key things, and that's that if it's an iron ore project, then in areas, then there is potentially the opportunity to use somebody else's plant, and we take back the slag and extract the vanadium.
Yeah, well, that sounds like a wonderful plan. I think we've got the bones of the strategy out of you. So, we're, you know, it's quite fun. I mean, we had at the end of 2023, there was some holes reported. You did 1,394 meters scout diamond holes. drilled a Ariake 200 license. And again, like 0.52% vanadium pentoxide and 0.72% vanadium pentoxide in a couple of those holes. Those are very good grades. And then you were talking about the JORC resource, it could be extended for another 2 whole kilometers north as well. So it feels like, given how many licenses you have, it could be quite a massive system under there that you just haven't been able to completely explore yet. Would you say that's probably true, or do you think you found most of what you're looking for now?
No, I think there is potential for significantly more, absolutely. There's two things. There's two similar other answers to that. The first is that, you know, I've been in the business a reasonable amount of time, and I do know that you get to a point where we want to avoid a situation where we spend more money on drilling and shareholders go, they've added another 20 million tons, so what? And the share price doesn't respond. So we have to be, you know, careful in that regard. The other thing, of course, is that it is seasonal. You know, we can only drill at certain times of the year because otherwise, you know, we're impacting on the city environment and it gets pretty boggy and messy and all the rest of it. So there is a limit, and we are a junior and you know, we have a treasury that we have to manage. So whilst it would be nice to get 4 drill rigs and throw them all at the project and get them going 24/7, it's a case of, you know, being able to finance it. So we've got to try and find that happy medium. So I think we've got the 40 odd million tons now. If we can add materially to that, and then we can announce our strategy and we can demonstrate that our test work shows that we've got an extractable project, then I think we're a long way to achieving our goal.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, that particular license is one that I'm definitely keeping an eye on. And the idea that, you know, that you potentially will be able to just blast the ore away and then bring that ore to another plant to extract the iron and then get the slag out and then extract vanadium yourself, or, you know, with a second partner potentially. Again, this is something that could be really, really interesting. And then the fact that you know, there's still more to drill should you get, you know, if the market turns, if the risk appetite comes back, which hopefully it will later on this year, lots of interesting stuff.
Sure, exactly. One other bit that's been very interesting. We attended a seminar which was organised by the Norwegian government, and there were representatives from the whole of sort of Fenniskandia there from the mining industry, and the whole thing was suddenly everybody's woken up to the fact that vanadium and nickel and so on are very much strategic metals. And I think that's the other area where we've got renewed confidence now in our projects in the region is that the governments are now sort of going, hang on, we need to protect our local supplies and try and support the local producers.
Yeah, security of supply, isn't it, rather than pricing, especially the political world we have now. You know, I was speaking to Japan at Sovereign Metals, and they've got this massive titanium rutile project, or Oliver at Golden Metal, and they've got the largest undeveloped tungsten deposit in the United States. And both of those companies, while they've got very differing market caps, are still, in my view, very undervalued, simply because tungsten, titanium, and then, you know, with Kendrick, vanadium, these are metals where if China turns around and goes, hang on, you can't have any of ours anymore, you're going to run into big problems very quickly. So yes, you know, I think that vanadium in particular, I think the difference, I guess, between vanadium and other metals is that there just aren't very many vanadium-based opportunities in London. There's a couple of larger ones, but there's none where you can kind of get in on the bottom, on the ground floor, you know, and hold essentially gold. But yeah, no, it's really interesting to hear that. I mean, we're hearing exactly the same things pretty much all over the Western world, that security of supply, which is what China has always been about, ironically, is more important than the pricing. And I guess the problem is that comes up against the capitalist system of mining boom and bust, where in the boom years, obviously, you get lots of capital expenditure. And in the bust years, it just doesn't happen. And I suppose in the junior resource sector, there needs to be a way that juniors can still be financed, even when metal prices are a bit depressed, which they should be able to. But obviously, it's tied up with what the majors are up to, and they have to, you know, be responsible to their own shareholders as well. But, you know, it always turns in the end, and whoever's holding the trump cards will do very well. Yeah, obviously, you mentioned nickel. I mean, Espeladen Nickel, which is based in Norway, I would say maybe not your flagship, but definitely another very advanced project. And you extended mineralization recently, didn't you? So that was at Stormyra? Is that how you pronounce it?
Stormyra, yeah.
Yeah. So can you tell me a little bit about Espeladen?
It's actually quite a big, it's a complex. And there are a number of deposits there, all of which sort of fall within our license. And at this stage, the highest grade is the Stormira deposit. At the moment, we've got just over 1 million tons at 1% nickel, just under 0.5% copper, and a reasonable cobalt grade. We did a little bit of drilling, and we have done some more ground geophysics, which has extended the deposit another 500 meters to the south-southeast, which needs to be drilled. The other thing that the geophysics showed up was these deposits are all relatively close to surface, and or Stormira. And what the geophysics threw up was another quite substantial anomaly at depth, which may be the roots of this system, which is very exciting on the basis that, you know, we've got Stormira, but, you know, in addition to that, we've got, there's a project called Megrund, so there's one called Darlin, which is lower grade, but it's nearly 8 million tons. And we've got 10 other prospects, each of which have got at least one borehole in it with mineralized intercepts of 1% plus nickel. So it's a big system. And if we potentially have found the roots of this, then that's quite exciting. But what we like about Espadanen is that it fits in with our, to take a step back, we set our stall out as an explorer and a small miner, you know, looking specifically at nickel and vanadium, and in brackets sort of copper in this area. And like a lot of other people, we were looking to see what was going on in terms of, you know, the Paris Agreement and the rest of it. And when you've got 70% of, you know, the countries that make up 70% of global GDP and all the emissions and things are definitely committed to net zero, then, you know that you've got to sort of, you've got to piggyback off that if you can. The interesting dilemma you've got is when you look at that net zero time frame and you look at the quality of mineral resources that are out there right now. I read something the other day that was really interesting by the International Energy Agency, and they were talking about one of the larger copper producers worldwide based in South America, where their run-of-mine grade had dropped by 30% in the last 50 years.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, in other words, to produce the same amount of copper, they've got to produce three times the tons, three times the amount of processing, a lot more energy consumed, a lot more emissions, and all the rest of it. Whereas, so we see an opportunity for us with a project like Espadanen because, yeah, we've got a quicker response time, we've got a smaller footprint, potentially we've got a shorter lead time to production now that, you know, the Scandinavian governments are recognizing the strategic importance of these metals and minerals. You know, we can be a little bit more flexible because we're smaller. And as you'll see from the grade at Espadanen, just by its very nature, because it's smaller, it's only going to work if we've got a sufficiently high grade.
Yeah.
So, you know, if we can build good relationships with domestic buyers, and there is a growing sort of battery industry, particularly on that sort of the southern Norwegian coast, then, you know, I think we've got something here that we can develop. We really only scratched the surface. We've got these 10 other targets that we need to work on.
You've got masses, but when I was doing the article and trying to go through them, I was like, I've got to pick a couple that I find the most interesting. I'll be here for about 3 weeks trying to get through them all. I mean, nickel, I mean, vanadium, I'm very positive on because, as you say, it just tied into steel demand, which is only going to rise over time. But it's also got, you know, with the redox batteries, it's got that sort of growth potential as well. Whereas nickel seems to be just one of those metals that run into demand problems with China and Indonesia building more and more dirty nickel projects. You know, BHP, which had one of the lowest cost nickel operations in the world, they just took a $2.5 billion impairment on the West Australian operations. So I guess the argument, you know, the question is, will this nickel project at Espadanen, or just in general, you know, is it going to be easy to get investment, or is it going to be on the back burner until nickel prices rise again?
That's an interesting question.
Sorry for a difficult question now.
No, it's interesting because we've been having a discussion for quite some time now because, you know, if you're looking at nickel sulfide, it's pretty simple mining. It's pretty simple, you know, flotation technology. You know, you're not looking at a need for sort of pyro and met for certain laterite, nickel and things. I mean, it's all relatively straightforward. So quite often we're sitting there scratching our heads going, well, look, you know, we've got a 1% nickel project. We've got relatively easy mining conditions, quite shallow. We got a price of $17,500 a ton. So if you look at, you know, copper, and you got copper at 9,000, let's say, also 1%. Now, people can make good money on the 1% copper project. Why couldn't they make good money on 17,500 nickel at the same sort of width, same grades, same depths? And I think it is a function, as you say, of scale. I think it's a function of, there's obviously a lot of politics involved. You know, if you think 50% of all exploitation is basically confined to Indonesia, Philippines, and Russia.
Yeah.
And I think in terms of refining capacity, it's even higher. I think it's over 60% is just China, Indonesia, and Japan.
Japan. Yeah.
So from that point of view, you know, people are twitchy and the markets are obviously twitchy and prices do fluctuate. And as you say, it is supply driven and things. So, but I think, again, I think we're getting to a point, or we're not far away from the point where, you know, if we can double this resource, you know, if you've got a 2 million ton, you know, 1% plus nickel and a nice copper byproduct, and it's a small footprint and it's fairly sort of low key, you've got Europe, you're 100 miles away from, you know, a whole load of battery factories, then I think you've got a very good chance of being able to develop something like this.
That's a very good answer. I mean, well, it's interesting because the nickel price in the dumps, well, not in the dumps, is lower than it has been in recent years. It's essentially because China continues to open more and more nickel mines in Indonesia, as you mentioned. But these are dirty mines, right? They scoop up this near surface low grade ore. It damages all the environment, huge pollution, coal fired electricity, often lignite coal. It's really, really damaging. I mean, there is a big push from a lot of campaigners to separate out the green nickel, which is essentially the nickel produced in Australia and Canada, and the sort of nickel you'd be getting from Kendrick, which, you know, is more environmentally friendly and should have a price premium. I think that's something that could happen in the future, especially, you know, because consumers are pretty conscious of environmental damage. And the idea, for example, that you'd be able to say, right, we got our nickel out of this mine 100 miles away, and it's, you know, ethically sourced, essentially. That's something which could help you out. Now, you did say there's 10 drill-defined anomalies and they're waiting to be tested. How long are you investors going to be waiting for them to be tested? Or is that something that's concrete, about to be planned out, or something that's going to be a few months in the future?
I think that'll be a secondary target. I think our priority at this stage will be the 500-meter extension of the Stormira.
Right.
And then it'll be a case, hopefully, of me being able to persuade the board, which I don't think will be a challenge because they like it as well, to test the deep anomaly or deeper anomaly that we've got there, just to see what what we've got. And then I think with those other targets, it's one of the other things about this part of the world is that the geological surveys in Sweden and Finland, or where actually, are they were given a government directive not so long ago to be of assistance. And
rather than try to disrupt you every
time. It's fantastic. You know, we attended a conference last year and lots of guys from the various agencies were saying, what can we do to help? And we've had a couple of guys have done some fantastic research and mapping, structural mapping and things. And we think we've got, for various reasons, we won't go into the detail, but we think we've got two different types of sort of ore genesis here. And I think those 10 projects are more structurally related. And as a result, we want to do a little bit more work first before we start drilling holes into them again, because they are slightly more complicated than Stormira, which is very, very straightforward.
Right.
So we just want to make sure that...
You don't want to waste money drilling holes where you don't need to be, is what you're saying.
Correct. Well, my chairman will always tell you, which is music to any geologist, is that, you know, even a hole that misses is a useful hole because it's
true.
Something. But yeah, it'd be nice to hit the numbers every time. I think with a little bit more work and more consultation with the geological survey, I think we can achieve that.
Last thing on Storm Mirror. I mean, you say it's very simple and very straightforward. What do you mean by that? Specifically, it is about the mineralogy. I can't do it. I can't say it. Can't get it right. What's simple about it?
Only the mineralogy, but more. I'm talking more about the morphology of it. You know, it's a long, continuous, relatively flat line mass.
Right.
So it's not bits here and bits there. It's something that we can sort of grab hold of and stick holes in. So it's pretty simple in that respect.
Okay, gotcha. Right, that fills it in for me. Martin, like, I would like to ask a couple of questions about yourself. So you have more than 40 years of experience in geology. You have an MSc in mining exploration from the Camborne School of Mines, which is pretty much the gold standard. You've been with, you know, various AIM mining companies in the past. Are there any kind of like points in your career that you would say are highlights?
I mean, I've enjoyed it all, to be frank. You know, I was very fortunate because I started off at a time when, you know, the sort of the big mining houses would come down to call and do what they used to call the milk run. And they'd buy lots of beers and offer you jobs. And you end up going to places like South Africa, where as a youngster, you're given a huge amount of responsibility. You know, it'd take me years and years to get elsewhere. So you get thrown into the deep end. And I'd be very fortunate. I'd be thrown into the deep end, you know, various places. You know, Namibian Independence, Goldfield sent me up there to another place. I went and opened the office in the Tarkwa in Ghana as well, which is now a 15, I think it's more than 15 million ounce deposit. So yeah, I've spent my time with the majors, and equally, you know, I've enjoyed working with the junior companies, because they're particularly some of the places where we're working, because there are opportunities to make new discoveries.
Yeah, and make a decent amount of money as well. Indeed. Well, I don't know. I mean, like, this is the thing, isn't it? I mean, I was talking with a plant contractor actually the other day. One of the medium sized ones. They were saying how there's kind of a dearth of new people coming into mining. It seems that everybody, you know, it seems to me anyway that it's much harder if you're like an 18-year-old or a 20-year-old and you want to get started in mining, and you're based in the UK, for example. It's very difficult to know where to point you. Where do you go? How do you start off? If you want to get a degree, you need to have experience first. Where do you get that? What would you say to somebody who is, you know, 22, 23 and wanted to get started in the mining world? Where would they go first?
Good question.
Yeah, sorry, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, people always seem to be
interested in it.
We don't have the pipeline of new talent, but there's no signposts, are there?
You don't. And I tell you what, the guys that we employ, we jokingly say to them, you're probably never going to retire, because there's just not the flow through of, you know, geologists and mining engineers now. I mean, I've heard a number of times people say the average age of a mining engineer is something like 60 now, and a geologist is not far behind, which is crazy. If you want to start, you can go whichever way you want, but I think there are merits to both. If you join one of the bigger companies, then yes, it's structured. Yes, you know, you're sort of constrained is not the right word, but you know, there's a lot more protocol and things to follow. But you will get parachuted into projects, and you will get some invaluable exposure to, you know, how things are done really well when you've got plenty of money and all the rest of it. And then maybe to go and join, you know, join the junior sector. I think the best exploration geologists I've ever met are the ones that started out working on mines. And I think that is definite, without a shadow of a doubt, the best geos I've ever worked with are guys that have worked on the mines first, because they know what a deposit looks like.
Yeah.
What you have to have.
Well,
it does make a difference.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like how if you want to be a chef, but there's plenty of restaurants, you have to be the dishwasher for a few months first. Because you have to put in the hard yards, don't you, to actually know. I was a CEO, I won't name him, but he was saying how when you are doing like the initial surface level exploration, if you've been on a mine before, you know what's good and what's not, without having to do any kind of like official stuff, you know what I mean? There's stuff that you can't really put into words, that you look at it and you go, yeah, this could be something interesting, but you can't know that unless you've worked on mine.
Absolutely, 100% agree with that. And also, you know, you can end up saving your company an awful lot of money.
Yeah, exactly.
You can basically say, look, it ain't going to work. Move on.
Well, you could exactly, and you could have, for example, five targets, and one person with more experience can rule out four, or not even rule out four of them, but say this is the one we should go with first. And 9 times out of 10, they're right. That's the one they should have gone with first. But you need to have that level of experience. And you know, obviously with your 40 years of geological, you know, of geology, you know, you definitely have it. But it's just sad to me that, you know, the younger generation just isn't coming through. I guess my question is, what's going to happen when, you know, people in their late 50s, 60s, 70s all start to retire, and we need more metal mined out of the ground than ever before to decarbonize the economy, but there isn't going to be anybody to do it. So if you can get it, I guess my message is, if you want to get into mining and you can get into it now, this is the right time, because it's going to be a lucrative career in the next couple of decades.
100% agree with that. Yeah. And you know, there is a shortage, and you wouldn't struggle to find a job, that's for sure.
Indeed. I mean, just one more asset I want to briefly touch on is that Koitalainen, is that how you pronounce it? I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm trying. Koitalainen, it's a single granted exploration permit. It covers almost 14 square kilometers. Palladium, platinum, chrome, rhodium, and vanadium. The interesting thing about this project, the Kevitsa mine, which is owned and operated by Boliden, is only 30 kilometers from this asset. Do you think this is another one that maybe investors aren't paying attention to? This is another one that just kind of caught my eye.
Yeah, look, it is principally a vanadium target, and you know, there is a resource there. It's lower grade than Ariake.
It is.
So I would say it's a sleeper
one. Okay.
Yeah.
It's just so close to an already operating mine. I can just see, you know, the connection there. But no, one on the back burner then, potentially.
Correct.
That one.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Fair enough. I mean, in terms of, okay, so I think, you know, just before we finish up, I think it's important to, because you've touched on it before, but talk about Scandinavia and its reputation for mining, because I mean, my personal perspective is that sentiment is much better than, you know, most of Europe, and particularly Western Europe. You've got all weather railways running close to most of your assets. The Kiruna mining hub is in northern Sweden, and there's this major nickel smelter in southern Norway. From what you're saying, it feels like investors are potentially not understanding that, you know, perhaps the sentiment has changed a lot more positively over the past couple of years. Is that broadly correct?
Yes, most definitely. And they are, you know, they're way ahead. I mean, you look at Kiruna, which is, I think, the largest underground iron ore mine in the world. And some of the technology and things they've introduced is just spectacular. Was very fortunate to visit London's Zeebruggen mine. And you can turn up at the mine there, you wouldn't know there was a mine there, quite frankly. You know, there was a million tons of ore a year coming out from underground. Wow. You wouldn't have known it. It was just remarkable the way it's organized. And that's the same throughout Scandinavia. The technology, the organization, the strategies that they adopt. You know, you're running quite substantial mines with an unbelievably small labor force, highly automated, clean. You know, it's got an awful lot going for it. And as I said, you know, the legislation, you know, it's not onerous. It's actually, I think it got that reputation simply because it was one of the first places to actually implement proper environmental legislation. Everyone in the air. The reality is, it's been there for a long time. It works. And as long as you follow the rules, and as long as you submit when you're supposed to, and, you know, we have a lot of dialogue with the community. Yeah, we go and see them. Even if we start a drill program, we'll go and see the community. And then when we've drilled the first couple of holes, we'll take some core down to show everybody. You know, it works. Keep people informed. Obviously, not everybody is going to like you all the time. It's just the way it is.
Indeed.
But it is okay. And I got a very good feeling from that conference the government organized in Norway a couple of months ago. Just very focused. And organized, and just talking to some of the other sort of Fenno-Scandian companies that were there and their CEOs and things, same thing. And you're having a conference, and the environmental groups are there participating, and everybody's having a grown-up conversation.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting.
Very interesting.
Yeah, well, Portugal, where there's Barroso, and the locals there don't want it developed. But at the same time, it's a country with, you know, some of the highest rates of people who want electrification of the economy. And you're just thinking, you know, there's got to be trade-offs there. You know, if you want the economy to be decarbonized, then you need to get metals out of the ground and at a rate faster than anything else before in history. So you have to have some kind of compromise. And I think people, to an extent, want to have their cake and eat it. And in Scandinavia, there seems to have finally been a general realization that there's going to have, if you want to get the economy decarbonized, you're going to have to get hold of metals, and you want to have your own native in-country plants and mines and deposits. You need to have security of supply, because you don't know, you know, in the world that we have now, where Russia invaded Ukraine, or you have Israel and the situation in the Middle East, and, you know, increasing tensions between China and the US, and export bans, for example, of graphite or rare earths from China. You don't know what's going to happen next. And it seems to me that you're well positioned to take advantage of that new understanding. Yeah. So my final question is, and I don't know whether this is still the grand plan, but at least it was a few months ago. You want to build a centralized plant in Finland to process vanadium magnetite concentrates. Presumably, you know, a partner would have to help build this. Is that still the plan, like the grand plan in the scheme of things? Or do you have multiple potential options?
I think multiple potential options. And I think with the next iteration of the website, that statement will probably
change a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fair enough. That's fair enough. I just want to clarify that anyway. Well, look, Martin, it's been really lovely to chat to you. I guess my final thing I want to say, you know, if you're listening to this and you're going, well, you know, this is all sounds really wonderful and, you know, X, Y, and Z, but there's still a way to go. This is only a £1 million market cap company, and it was worth a lot more at the IPO. And there's been significant progress since. I mean, in terms of financially, you're looking at the net asset value. You know, in June 2023, the net asset value, £5.36 million, right? So the value of the assets is more than five times what the market cap is. This is the point at which to just jump in, buy a few shares, hold them for a few years, and let Martin do his magic. So Martin, wonderful. Thanks for chatting. And let's hope we see some progress in the next few months.
Yep, Charles, thanks very much. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. Bye then.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.